I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to episode number 232 of Real Life Ghost Stories. And to kick things off this week, I would like to say thanks to some of our newest Patreon subscribers. I would like to thank Sirens Calling. Thank you so much for subscribing to the Patreon. I love you and appreciate you every single day. And our film review this week, our film review is Caveat. Caveat was released in 2020. It has 5.9 out of 10 on IMDb. And 81% on Rotten Tomatoes. A lone drifter, Isaac, suffering from partial memory loss, accepts a job from his old landlord, Barrett, to look after his niece, Olga, a psychologically troubled woman living in an abandoned house on an isolated island. When Barrett convinces Isaac to confine his movements to the house and leaves the two of them alone, a game of cat and mouse ensues, with Isaac fighting to survive amid the terrifying resurgence of his own memory. I definitely think this film is going to be a Marmite film. So people sometimes message me and they're like, what do you mean by a Marmite film? So Marmite is a sandwich spread here in the UK. Vegemite is similar in Australia, and it's a really bitter, sharp taste. And I'm pretty sure one of the advertising campaigns for Marmite back in the day was that you either love it or you hate it, which I think is a pretty brave thing to lean into. So that's what I mean by a Marmite film, is that people are really going to enjoy it or they're really going to hate it. So I watched this on the basis that it was allegedly a similar vibe to the film Possum. I reviewed that film quite a while ago now, but it really did stick with me. Like it was a very bleak, dark film, and I thought about it for genuinely weeks afterwards, and I didn't love it because it was so bleak and dark, and I don't think loving it is the right thing to say, but it was a brilliant horror film. So I was like, okay, I'm going to watch a film that is supposed to be similar to that vibe. It is definitely a film that is unsettling and creepy for sure. So there is no reliance upon jump scares, really. And if there are jumpy moments, they're relevant to the plot. It's quite a quiet film in that there isn't actually that much script. There is a lot of action in the film, and by that I mean a lot of people moving around quietly. So in the first kind of 20 minutes when Isaac gets to the house and he's kind of getting his bearings around the house, there is no script. It is very quiet. And I think that's very challenging for a horror film in a good way. There's often a lot you can build up through expositionary script. But in this, there isn't much of that. And actually, you're left, you don't know what's going on. Isaac doesn't know what's going on. Olga doesn't know what's going on. So there's a lot of unknown going on, which adds to the tension. The opening scene of this film really scared me. So I turned it on. It was quite late at night. I often don't watch horror films at nighttime. I often factor them in for the morning, just because it's easier with how my day flows, if you know what I mean. So I was watching this film at nighttime, in the dark, on my own, and the opening scene gave me the heebie-jeebies. She carries around this little terrifying rabbit toy. So you just have this vision of Olga walking around the house with this little rabbit toy that claps its hands or claps two little cymbals together. Sort of like the monkey toy in Phantom of the Opera, that kind of vibe. But she seems to be using the rabbit as some sort of dowsing rod. Like it can sense things in the house. It gave me the heebie-jeebies. There were absolutely stunning performances as well in this film. So the girl that played Olga was fab. and the protagonist, Isaac, was also fab. There was a huge amount of like silent brooding, which I liked because it worked for the atmosphere. And I respected it. I appreciated it. I didn't realise that this film was an Irish film, and I always like to champion Irish films. I like an Irish horror film. I try and engage with them as often as possible. And I think especially when they're trying to do something a bit different. And this film is definitely trying to do something a bit different. And like I've said kind of a few times lately, I have been really struggling with what Hollywood horror is churning out at the moment. I don't find it exciting. I don't find it good a lot of the time. So I really appreciate it when I watch a horror film that is just trying to be a bit different and trying to break the mold a little bit. And this film was definitely that. It was definitely different. Which brings me to my dislikes of this film. And this is one that seems to come up all the time for me. A huge portion of the end of this film is just in darkness. And I understand that that's the point. They are physically in a dark space. And you are sharing in that darkness. And it's meant to make you feel like you're claustrophobic and all of those things. But it does mean that I spent a large portion of the end of this film struggling to see what was happening on screen. Just up the brightness a little bit. I don't need to be squinting constantly trying to make out who's who and what's what and where people are going and where they are. It's really frustrating. It was like that bloody Batman film that came out, and I spent 90% of the film trying to figure out what was happening on screen because it was so bloody dark. I will admit that that is a technical quibble, but it is a technical quibble that very much annoys me in horror films. I also felt by the end of this film that there was a huge amount that was left unanswered. So I said in my likes column that there was a lot of ambiguity, there was a lot of questions that I had, there was a lot of who's who, who's in the right, who's wrong, who's the protagonist, who has done whatever is supposed to have been done in the house. And that's fine for a time, but I did feel like there was a huge amount of unanswered questions at the end. And I do think that some people will find that frustrating. I did. It didn't feel like it was unanswered in order to leave you questioning and discussing. But actually, it felt like there was just weird loose ends in the story because those caveats were used. Oh, see what I did there? Because those caveats were used for creep factor rather than to be a cohesive part of the story. I did feel that some moments and items in the film were just there to make it spooky and creepy rather than it adding anything to the actual narrative. And it was only at the end that I was like, hang on a second, why was that there? Why were they using that? How did that happen? That was weird. And I sort of thought after, you know, after the first maybe 45 minutes, there were so many twists and turns in the story that I sort of stopped caring. I was like, oh, just put everybody on the island and leave them there to rot and be done with it. I don't care anymore. Except the dog. Get the dog off the island. Leave everybody else there to do whatever they need to do. I don't care. The tension of the last 15, 20 minutes, I thought was good. You know, it was dark, but when I could see what was happening, I was into it and it got quite spooky. I'm not entirely sure that I understood how or why certain things were happening, but they were happening and they gave me the heebie-jeebies. So, you know, it got to the point where I was about an hour into the film and I had, I think, 20 minutes left. And I decided I'm not watching this last 20 minutes before I go to bed because it was quite late. So I turned it off and finished off the really scary bits in the morning. So, you know, there was obviously some spookiness that was giving me the heebie-jeebies and making me feel things. I think for me, one of the things I really dislike in horror films is sort of cat and mouse chases. I get very bored of them very quickly, and then I get very much like, oh, I don't care, it's too much, just one of you kill the other or something, or both of you, I don't know, fling yourselves out a window. I can't do it anymore, it's too much. And look, there's definitely a possibility that this is one of those films that went over my head, where there was some deep hidden meaning that meant something, and there were bits, threads that I missed, and bits that I didn't pick up on that made the story tie together. I'm perfectly willing to accept that that might be the case, but I felt like it was a really great attempt, but maybe it needed more finessing. That's how I felt about it. Fundamentally, I think give it a go. It's trying to do something different, which I respect, especially in an oversaturated horror genre that is churning out the same formulaic stuff time and time again. I'm going to give it 3 stars. That's 3 stars for caveat.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Which brings us to our story this week. And our story this week has nothing to do with dousing rabbits or putting yourself into situations that scream paranormal activity and death. No, our story today is all about different Glasgow poltergeists. Now, I came across this original story and I hoped against all hope that it would be detailed and juicy. It was not, but it led me down a rabbit hole of different Glasgow poltergeists, and weirdly, there are a lot of Glasgow poltergeist stories. The vast majority of my information today came from or was adapted from a book called Uncanny Clydeside by MJ Steele Collins. I got it on Amazon Kindle. It is very good, very interesting, worth a read. I think I got it for like £1 something. So if that sounds like something you would be interested in reading, then I highly recommend it. Let's crack straight into these stories. If a story contains a flying dog, then I am invested. I don't really care what the outcome is, and I'm not entirely bothered about the content as a whole. Just tell me about the flying dog. In 2016, a family in Rutherglen, just south of Glasgow, Scotland, were forced to leave their home because of some wild poltergeist activity. The story starts when a woman and her teenage son contacted the police in a state of distress. Their house, it seemed, was under siege. They reported to the police that there had been disturbing incidents in their home, and they were at a loss as to what else to do but to call the police. They described to the police that they had been experiencing violent and unexplained disturbances, and the police attended, expecting to be confronted with a situation that was caused by mental health issues rather than anything supernatural or paranormal. They were wrong. When the police attended the scene, they witnessed occurrences that can only be described as bizarre. Clothes flew across the room, the oven door repeatedly opened and closed, seemingly of its own accord. Lights were turning on and off as lampshades were turned upside down with no apparent human intervention. But the absolute cherry on top for me, anyway, was the family dog. The dog was in the garden, and when the family, and presumably the police officers, went outside, the dog was on top of a 7-foot-tall hedge. The dog in question was a tiny chihuahua. It was then reported that the officers called their superiors. Their superiors attended and also witnessed the strange phenomena. These phenomena had been going on for 2 days before Catherine Shreenan and her son had called the police. So, what then? According to reports in the Daily Record, the police, with the support of the family, called a local priest. The family were devout Catholics, and there were no laws being broken, so everyone was at a loss as to what to do. It is also alleged that the police attempted to call previous residents of the house in order to ascertain as to whether or not they too had experienced any paranormal activity. A source told the Daily Record that the officers attended, expecting it to be a mental health issue, but they witnessed the lights going off, clothes flying across the room, and the dog sitting on top of the hedge. The officers called their superiors, who also attended, thinking the cops were perhaps being a bit silly, but it's being taken very seriously. The fact it was witnessed by our officers has lent itself to a very different but active inquiry. The main concern is the family's welfare and well-being, but with no crime committed and no culprit, we are at a loss how to proceed with it. Inquiries are ongoing, but it's difficult to know where to go with it. But officers with more than 20 years' service are saying they've never seen anything like this. It really is something that down-to-earth police officers are having trouble getting their heads around. How do you handle what, despite us not liking to use the word, has been described as a poltergeist? The family moved out due to the disturbances, but it is also reported that the police helped them to locate help and services via doctors and social services, which is a welcome update in stories such as this. The family were mercilessly trolled after the story was posted online, and Catherine spoke to newspapers only to say that she did not want to discuss the story further, that she had been under unimaginable stress during this time, and that she had no desire to be in the newspapers. Her neighbours stated that it was nice to have a bit of excitement on the street for a change. Throughout the years, there have been numerous reports of poltergeist encounters. The word poltergeist entered the common vernacular in 1848 in a book called The Night Side of Nature by Catherine Crowe, which offered stories about everything supernatural, from ghosts to doppelgangers to premonitions and, of course, poltergeist manifestations. Poltergeist manifestations happen literally all over the world, and they tend to start very suddenly, throwing the victims' lives into turmoil, and then end just as suddenly as they started. Poltergeists are one element of the supernatural that remain fixed firmly in public consciousness. And interestingly, Glasgow seems to have been a hotbed for poltergeist encounters. A story in the Glasgow Herald in 1929 tells of a tenement in Cowcaddens, which had to be guarded by the police to protect it and its inhabitants from curious onlookers who had heard reports of the residents being haunted. It was alleged that it was plagued by a mysterious and intelligent rapping sound. Another Glasgow Herald story tells that in 1958, American students that were studying at Glasgow University fled their flat on Gibson Street after they saw their eggs dancing on a shelf, along with their breadboard. They also heard disembodied voices emanating from their radio, and once when they had approached the radio to turn it off, it had instead switched itself on. Neighbours were undisturbed by any supernatural happenings, which led some to speculate that the students may be misinterpreting standard Glasgow rumblings and sounds. For example, the dancing eggs may have simply been caused by the rumbling of buses and traffic. And the voices, well, they were just neighbours coming and going. In the 1960s and 70s, a man named Paul Anderson and his wife lived in a flat in Govan Cross, and one ordinary Friday evening they returned home to find a crucifix that was hanging on a chain, spinning and twisting wildly on the wall. At first the movements were slow, but it built up into a frenzy of movement which, understandably, terrified the Andersons. They watched in horror until eventually the swinging stopped and the flat was calm. But then they began to hear the cries of babies, even though there were no babies in the neighbouring flats. Paul became so convinced that there was a skeleton of a baby in the flat that he pulled out the fireplace in the bedroom, completely convinced that he would find the skeletal remains of an infant, but he found nothing. According to the website Spooky Isles, in 1968, Lachlan and Mary Hanlon became the butt of their unsympathetic friends' jokes after leaving their tenement flat in Mansfield Street, Partick, claiming it to be haunted. Phenomena had increased from an inexplicable rapping to a strange whirring sound. Temperature drops, glowing shapes hovering above the bed, and Lachlan being thrown from his seat by an unseen force. The couple, who had become the butt of their friends' jokes, enlisted the help of a local newspaper, the Evening Citizen, and were accompanied back to their flat by reporter Jim Brown, who witnessed Lachlan huddling precariously close to the fire, claiming to be freezing and the letterbox rattling by itself. The poltergeist was more active whenever the bed recess was occupied, where a previous elderly tenant had been found dead a few years prior. To give a bit more detail on this particular case, like many others, Lachlan and Mary resorted to calling the police, who apparently witnessed Lachlan being thrown screaming from his chair. This newspaper reporter witnessed the drastic changes in temperature and surmised from the couple that the activity seemed to get worse whenever someone was in the bed recess. The reporter turned off the lights and witnessed a strange glowing orb above the bed recess that he could not account for. And at 2 a.m, the occupants of the flat witnessed the letterbox rattling aggressively. And that's not all. This undated case tells of a family who moved into a flat in Glasgow with a six-month-old baby and were absolutely assailed by poltergeist activity. Eventually they left and a psychic entered the home and told the young family that the activity had been caused by a family member who was trying to warn them that their six-month-old baby had swallowed something that was now stuck in its throat. The couple booked the child in for an x-ray, and sure enough, there was a foreign body lodged in the child's trachea, which could have proved fatal if it had moved or dislodged. And then there was the case of the Ballernock poltergeist, a case that came before the Enfield poltergeist, but a case that had many similarities. This case, interestingly, involved two families. They lived in the North Gate quadrant of Ballernock in two flats, one above the other. In the top flat were the Greaves family. The Greaves family consisted of David, his wife Elizabeth, their two children, Derek, 14, and Jeffrey, 11, and Elizabeth's elderly mother. In the flat below were the Keenan family, James and his wife and their son, Gordon, who was 30 years old. The families did not see eye to eye, and our story really starts on the 3rd of November 1974. Derek and Jeffrey, the two sons of the Greaves family, were in their bedroom asleep when they were both awoken by loud knocking. They did not know what this was, but they suspected the knocking was coming from the Keenans downstairs. The knocking persisted and was loud and irritating, so the boys made their way to their parents' room to tell them what was happening and to try and get some much-needed sleep. But the noise followed, and the rapping knocks continued in their parents' bedroom. The noises continued from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. the following morning, 8 hours of consistent, unrelenting knocking. The Greaves phoned the police, believing that the Keenans were purposefully trying to disrupt their sleep, and the police did indeed call out the Keenan home and warned them against purposefully antagonizing and disturbing their neighbors. The police left, and the noises continued, and so the Greaves called the police again, and this time the Keenans were arrested. The three members of the Keenan family were marched off to Springburn Police Station, and of course, while there, the knocks and the rapping continued. The Greaves family remained utterly convinced that the Keenans were still responsible for this, that one of the three had been allowed back into the flat and were continuing the auditory harassment. David Greaves was so convinced that when the Keenans returned from the police station, a fight broke out. But of course, the events would only escalate, and soon it became abundantly clear that the Keenans were not the source of the noise, especially when ornaments began to float into the air. The rapping continued throughout this, and the family realized that the rapping often came in the rhythm of Handel's The Dead March. As is common in many poltergeist cases, Elizabeth figured out a method of knocks to communicate with the entity, and this communication would lead to messages that did not seem to make any logical sense. The entity stated through a series of knocks that it was the spirit of the miners who had been killed in a mining accident that was caused by Mr. Keenan, who lived downstairs when he was managing a mine. Except he had never managed a mine or even worked in one that anyone knew of. Messages came that requested that Mr. Keenan be strangled. The Greaves grew increasingly tired and frustrated and scared, and they fled their home, making their way to Mrs. Greaves' sister, but to no avail. The poltergeist followed them. While they were there, they experienced the same levels of activity: floating ornaments, spinning mirrors, a music box that played by itself, dripping water, and of course the ever-present knocks. The police were still involved in the case, and as were the housing officials. Both visited the two flats at the same time, and both heard knocking at the same time, and both believed that the knocking was coming from the other flat. Each team of professionals that was visiting the families thought the other family was responsible. It was tricky. The police and the housing services turned to Reverend Murdo Ewan MacDonald, a university professor, for assistance. He went to the flat and experienced the poltergeist activity for himself and listened to reports of levitating coffee tables and flying ashtrays. He decided that with the help of an assistant, he would perform an exorcism. And it seemed to work. For a few weeks at least. Until the boys went back to school in January. The boys hated school, Derek in particular, and the poltergeist activity started right back up again, and this time it was markedly worse. The knocks were no longer sharp raps, but huge bangs that shook the house. The Greaves family began to make a record of the events that were happening in the home. They would flee to their relatives and the activity would follow. When they returned home, the house was completely trashed. Furniture had been upended and thrown around. Toys were smashed to pieces or stuffed down the toilet. When Derek went to school, the activity followed. Pencils would move around of their own accord and doors slammed around him. When he was traveling in his dad's car, there were always issues. The electrics would fail and the journeys became increasingly difficult. And then it began to target Jeffrey. Although it is difficult to say how the poltergeist gave a small boy seemingly superhuman strength. Allegedly, Jeffrey managed to kick a wardrobe away from a wall and overpower his uncle, who was 6'2" and weighed 16 stone. Perhaps this is the first time in a story where height and weight have been actually very important. Local Ghostbusters now became involved. The family were suffering. The boys were being bullied in school. They were attacking the adults with an impressive strength. The boys would contort their bodies into strange positions and one day, Derek, without having any prior knowledge or interest, was suddenly adept at difficult card tricks. Mediums with paltry solutions came and went. A consultant psychiatrist visited and there was no evidence of either ill health or a hoax. And on the 23rd of May 1975, it stopped. On that day, Mr. James Keenan, the downstairs neighbour, passed away. Although the case was all but over, in late 1975, there was a resurgence of the activity that coincided with Derek leaving school and being very stressed about seeking employment. But once he found his dream job as an electrician, the activity stopped and it never started back up again. Another couple in Partick experienced similar disturbances. They awoke one morning to find their flat in absolute chaos. Everything had been strewn around, including large items of furniture. The window of their living room was smashed. And here's the really strange part. Every single item of crockery, every plate, every ornament, every cup had been reduced to piles of fine coloured sand. This was a small tenement flat. The couple's bed was literally in the living room and they heard absolutely nothing. The window had been smashed from inside the room. The furniture had moved all around them and they slept through it all. In another interesting case, a man named James Montgomery had all of the usual poltergeist activity. But his bedroom would fill with smoke randomly from time to time with no discernible cause. And any time he put up new wallpaper, it lost its colour almost instantly. So is Glasgow a hotbed of poltergeist activity, or is there more poltergeist activity happening in towns and cities than we realise? I was hoping at this point in the episode to be able to give you a mic drop moment, like Glasgow is situated on an important ley line, but no such luck. I have no answers for this one. Just lots and lots of questions. So like I said, the majority of these stories came from a book called Uncanny Clydeside by M.J. Steele Collins, which I got on Amazon, and there was just a chapter on different poltergeists around Glasgow. And as you can see, there have been many. I added in that bit about ley lines at the end because I was like, maybe Glasgow is like on a ley line. So here's me Googling, you know, the ley line maps of the UK. I actually don't even know what a ley line is. For the longest time, I thought a ley line was an actual scientific thing. It is not. If you are like me and you did not know what a ley line is, brace yourself. I'm going to educate you. So I got this from a website called higgypop.com. And they said a ley line is a completely straight line across the landscape that runs from one landmark of historic importance to another and crosses through one or more similar landmarks along its route. It is often said that ley lines represent regions of earth energies and that it is no accident that these structures were built along the lines. Whether ancient civilizations really knew about these lines is debatable, but the modern day concept of ley lines comes from Alfred Watkins' book, The Old Straight Track. He wrote that ley lines can be plotted between various historic structures and that these represented trade routes created by ancient British societies. Ley lines start and end at prominent features and landmarks. These can be anything from distinctively shaped high hills, a significant peak, churches, castles, or even the locations of ancient wells and worship sites. These are known as terminal points and can be highly visible landmarks through to sites where buildings or structures once stood. The presence of a ley line running nearby is said to cause an increase in paranormal activity, and buildings on ley lines are often said to be supernatural hotspots, especially those built at the sites where two ley lines cross or meet. In recent years, ley hunters have uncovered similar lines in North and South America, as well as China, Australia, the Middle East, India, and parts of Africa. And I don't know what to tell you. Like I said, I always thought that ley lines were a scientific thing. They are not. They are just a series of lines drawn on maps from one point to another. And people saying everything in the middle is spooky. That's it. I mean, is it just me or can anybody draw a line from one monument to another monument on a map and say, ha ha ha, this is where paranormal shit happens. Anyway, after all of that, Glasgow is not in fact on a ley line. So I don't even know what that would have proven because I fundamentally don't really think that ley lines do anything. I don't even really understand what they are or how people have decided where to draw them. So after that complete non-starter of a paranormal explanation for the seemingly huge number of poltergeist cases that have happened in Glasgow, I started to think about what else could it be? Could it be a socioeconomic thing? Like, what is it that links all these people together? You know, not all of these people had teenage children in their flats or apartments or their homes, which is what we usually associate with poltergeist activity. But let's go right back to the beginning and the story that started all of this, which is the story of the flying dog. I'm sorry, it was clickbait. The dog didn't actually fly. I wanted it to be flying just as much as you did, but it didn't. I do, however, find it very amusing that the dog ended up on top of a 7 foot tall hedge when it was a tiny chihuahua. It was not hurt in this paranormal activity, just so everyone is aware. It was later reported that the dog was indeed absolutely fine. It is quite unusual to have such a recent case, 2016, be attended by the police and for the police to allegedly come out and say, hey, we don't really quite know what's going on here. We came out expecting to see a mental health issue. That's not what we're seeing. And I can understand that they came out expecting to see a mental health issue. And then suddenly they're like, oh, hang on a second. That's not what this is. It is very heartening to see a story that ends with the police didn't know what to do. So instead of shrugging their shoulders and walking away, they contacted social services and health services to see if they could be of any help to the family that were involved. And they seemed constantly to be kind of reinforcing the fact that their job was to help the family and make sure the family were okay. Now, what's frustrating about this story is we do have the woman's name who was involved in the case originally. She, like I said, was interviewed afterwards and she said, no, I don't want to talk about this. I don't want to be in the newspapers. This was a really horrible situation and I was absolutely terrified. But I can't find any other evidence as to anybody else that was involved in this particular story. There doesn't seem to be any named police officers, which I do kind of understand, because putting your name to something like saying, I think this is poltergeist activity, could be quite damaging to somebody's reputation in that kind of a job. So I understand why, but there doesn't seem to me to be any other sources for this story other than the Daily Record, which is why it ended up being just a paltry introduction and not the entire story for this episode. I was really excited for a story about a flying dog, but it didn't quite happen in the way that I imagined. It did make me a little bit sad to see that the family that were involved in this situation were trolled online afterwards when the story came out. And I wondered how the newspapers got the story, whether it was one of those police newspaper kind of hotlines, you know what I mean, where we all hear about these stories where the police tip off the newspapers for interesting stories, etc., etc. So I'm curious to know who contacted the newspapers. You know, this family called the police in complete despair. The police helped them. They called a priest at the family's behest. They called social services. They called doctors, whoever they could, in order to help this family. And the woman that was at the center of it, the mother at the center of it, did say that, like, I know this is really silly, but like gangs of teenagers were walking past the house singing Ghostbusters and cars were beeping outside and that kind of thing, which probably sounds really silly and probably a bit like, oh, really? Is that all? But I can imagine if you're at your wit's end and something has really terrified you and then you're seeing people aren't taking it seriously, that must feel pretty grim. Like that must feel pretty awful. And I didn't even bother trying to find the Facebook post with this news story attached to it, because I knew that if I read the comments, I would get really cross. I know that it seems to be a pretty easy target for jokes and it seems very victimless, but I can't imagine the stress somebody is going through when they're experiencing this. They don't know what the heck is going on. They're thinking, oh my God, who do I contact to help me with this? I have to call the police, but what am I telling them? Oh, hello, I have a poltergeist in my house. Please come and help me. And then I guess because the people who are seeing this story aren't taking it seriously, they're like, oh, I can make jokes about it. It's, you know, nobody's really going to get upset. But regardless of whether it's supernatural, whether it's paranormal, or whether it's somebody actually going through a mental health crisis, it's pretty grim to be, I would imagine, to see people making jokes about it online. I did, however, love the neighbour that was interviewed who said, yes, it's just really exciting. It's nice to see exciting things happening on the street. And to move forward with some of the other like brief stories that I included, I mean, there's the story of the house that had to be guarded by the police because people were so curious about the poltergeist that they believed was in the house. There is the American students who saw their eggs dancing. I'm dying to know what that means. What does their eggs dancing mean? Like, are they spinning around each other? Are they just vibrating on the spot? Are they bouncing up and down? What is happening? I want to know what that means. What does eggs dancing mean? And when their breadboard joined in, was it akin to a supernatural ballet? And then, of course, there was the story of the family who had the 6-month-old baby and they had loads of poltergeist activity. And then it was like, hey, actually, this is the ghost of a relative who is trying to tell you that there's something stuck in your baby's throat. A, that seems really, really specific. And B, it doesn't seem like a poltergeist story. It seems like a pretty crazy ghost story and a pretty nice ghost story. Like it had a good ending. The kid had something lodged in their trachea. Do you know what I mean? And they removed it. Brilliant. Happy days. Although that particular story genuinely made me think about, wow, if I can come back as a ghost, if I do die and I decide to come back as a ghost, I would rather come back as a poltergeist than like an apparition. I want to come back and be really annoying, slamming around, knocking, making noises, making things levitate, trash in the sitting room. You know, I'd like that. But to get into the kind of really meaty story of this episode, the story of the Greaves family and the Keenan family, I was really fascinated by this story. The first fascination that I had came from pure and utter nosiness. I wanted to know what the family had fallen out over because they obviously really didn't like each other and they obviously believed each other was responsible for this knocking and rapping that happened. Like, what went on in that house beforehand that the police arrested the downstairs family because apparently they were knocking on the walls? I don't know if I've ever heard of anybody being arrested for that, especially when it was only the second time in the individual night that it happened. There must have been some stuff that went on there beforehand, most definitely. Like, why were they so at odds with each other? And here is my thinking about this story, and I'm pretty sure that a lot of you listening will have come to this conclusion as well. I do think this is all centered around Derek, the 14-year-old, and to some degree Jeffrey, but I think more so Derek. And I'm not necessarily saying that I think these children hoaxed these events. That's not what I think. And even though I do like to try and keep a skeptical brain when I am discussing stories on the podcast, I think there's something about poltergeist stories that are really intriguing, and particularly when there are teenagers in the household. Is it possible that Derek had some sort of energy that was so potent that it created all of this chaos and commotion around him? And of course, it's very likely that Derek and Jeffrey knew that their mum and dad didn't like the Keenans downstairs. Like, they had witnessed them getting into a physical altercation on the night that the knocking began. So if they didn't know beforehand, they definitely knew then. And when Elizabeth Greaves developed her way of communicating with this entity, if this entity is created from the subconscious of Derek or Jeffrey or both, of course it makes sense that they would make Mr. Keenan the big bad villain, even if they were doing it completely subconsciously. And of course the fact that this poltergeist activity seemed to follow Derek. You know, they left the house in a panic, the poltergeist activity followed. It followed Derek into school. It followed him to the car. When he was in the car with his dad, the electrics would stop working. When the flat was trashed, when they weren't there, the poltergeist seemingly targeted the boys' toys, which is incredibly personal to the two boys. We also hear these stories of Jeffrey developing superhuman strength. And I would like to say that that is relative. We don't know from this story whether, you know, Jeffrey kicking a wardrobe, is he moved it a little bit from the wall or he booted it the whole way across the room. We don't know about him, you know, overpowering his uncle. What does that actually mean? His uncle, who was 6'2" and weighed 16 stone. I couldn't help but get in a little dig about the height and weight. But we don't actually know what overpowering means. So not that I'm dismissing that particular part of the story, but I do think it's interesting that both of the boys began attacking the adults that were involved in this story and contorting their bodies into strange positions. And then one day Derek is suddenly brilliant at card tricks. Again, there are elements of that that could be contextually actually quite explainable. And then it's really interesting that when Mr. Keenan, who is seemingly the source of a lot of family aggression, a lot of family anger, when he dies, it stops. Until a brief period when Derek leaves school and is trying to decide what career he wants to do. And then it kicks back up again. Genuinely, if there was one kind of paranormal idea or theory that was proven to be true, and it was the theory that teenagers going through puberty or going through particularly difficult times can create an energy that causes chaos around them in the form of poltergeist activity, if that was proven to be true, I wouldn't be surprised. And I wouldn't have a hard time believing it. And I included these final two kind of bits of stories because I liked the little detail in them. I like when we find a poltergeist story that has something new, some new little weird thing that the poltergeist does that makes you go, ooh, we haven't seen that before. So these last two stories, I know they probably felt like a bit of a tease, but actually it is all the information that I have about them. I don't have anything else substantial to tell you. I really liked the information that all of the crockery in that couple's living room had been ground into a fine sand. Like, that's a pretty stunning detail and I love it. I wish I had more details on the case or some sort of tangible proof that we could talk about. But the fact that they were asleep in that room and all of that allegedly happened around them and apparently they didn't wake up. And I thought a lot about this because I thought, oh, maybe this was a case of like domestic violence, and in order to cover up what happened, they said, oh, it must have been a poltergeist. We slept through it all. But there's two things about that. Firstly, I don't know if I've ever come across a case of domestic violence where the abuser has ground all of the crockery into a fine coloured sand. But there's also the fact that if they had absolutely smashed the place to bits in the night, like smashed windows in, moved furniture around, smashed all the crockery, and you're in a tenement flat, somebody else in that tenement building is going to have heard what happened. And I really don't think if it was a domestic violence situation that the couple would be going, yeah, it was a poltergeist, because you'd have neighbours going, aye, poltergeist, was it? Right, I'm sure it was a poltergeist, you dickhead. And in my brain, right, I'm imagining what is happening that night. So they're lying there, they're asleep in bed, presumably, allegedly, they're not hearing a single thing that's happening in the room around them. So is everything being silently broken? Are they in some sort of trance or stupor that they can't hear anything? You know, when the items are being ground down into a fine sand, do they just sort of disintegrate? Or do they smash and then get ground down over time? Like, what does the trashing of a room as a result of a poltergeist infestation, allegedly, what does that actually look like in action? I'm dying to know. And I had to include the final detail of the wallpaper that would lose its colour almost instantly, because that's annoying. That's like high level poltergeist annoyance. That is ridiculous behaviour. So if I die and any of you suddenly have a poltergeist infestation and it's specifically sucking all the colour out of your nice wallpaper, just know that it's me, okay? Just know that it's me. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. As always, all the sources that I used for today's episode are in the description of this episode. If you would like to send in your story, you can do so by emailing it to reallifeghoststoriespodcast@gmail.com. You can also check out the website, that is reallifeghoststoriespodcast.com. And if you are desperate for some extra content, you can subscribe to the Patreon. That is patreon.com/reallifeghoststories, where for $5 a month or $2 a month, you get access to heaps of extra content, as well as every single main and mini episode completely ad-free. And on that note, I shall see you next time.